This is the Secrets We Share podcast, a show about the ins and outs, the ups and downs, and the left and rights of mental health care in Australia. Here's your host, Frances Carlton.
Welcome to Secrets We Share, brought to you by Secret Keeper Counselling. We talk all things mental health with clients and clinicians. There may be tears, laughters, some trigger, a little bit of learning, maybe some profanity, if you're lucky. So you've been warned, make yourself a cup of tea, sit down and listen as I talk to Rod and he shares a few of his secrets. And you're more than welcome to laugh and giggle.
I think there's going to be a lot of profanity, not just a little. So I've got my glass of wine while others might have their cup of tea. But secrets no longer they will be.
Well, yeah, I know. So, Rod, what are your three words to describe yourself?
Oh, curious, bordering on nosy. I would have been a great kind of, well, in Australia we have a term, don't be an Ida Jessup, which is an old character out of a TV show who was your busy bossy neighbour. I'm that kind of person. I'm very curious about the world. So curious would be my first component. I'm very hospitable and very welcoming.
I can confirm that.
You can confirm that. And I'm a bit of an aesthetic person. I really like spaces to have attention to detail about them. You know, I'm a very tactile person. I'm a very scent-orientated person. So if you come into the therapy rooms that I work in, there will be something to touch, usually something like a velvet or a really soft furnishing. There will be flowers. There will be a scent in the room. You will be offered a cup of tea or a glass of water in a nice glass or cup, not just something cheap and nasty. It's all about the experience for me.
So the experience is really important.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank you for inviting me into your home where I can.
You're here in my living room.
I am, where I can see the candles and I can see the beautiful flowers that you've picked out of your garden and I can smell the roasting chicken in the kitchen. So, you know, you also have some absolutely beautiful original art on the walls as well. So, thank you for inviting me into your home.
You're absolutely welcome. Someone actually asked me quite some time ago to write a bio, and the first thing I wrote was therapy is essentially hospitality. You are welcoming someone, all of that, those aspects of themselves into a room, and that's really my whole ethos. Therapy should be about a welcoming, good restaurant or those places where you go in and you feel welcome from the moment you step foot in the door.
Yeah, so that experience of meeting your clients is very important.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've talked about in previous episodes with the clinicians around the, you know, the importance of the relationship between the client and the relationship. How important is that for you as well as the aesthetic part?
I struggle with the kind of concept of relational, because good therapy should be relational of itself. I don't think you need to overly emphasize it. If you are in good sync with the client and if you're in good sync with yourself, then the relationship should just flow. As we will unpack, I'm a Gestalt therapist, and there has been a school of Gestalt that call themselves relational Gestalt therapists, and I'm like, well, Gestalt is relational in essence. I don't think you need to add the extra capital R to begin with. To kind of emphasize this, I remember doing an experiment with someone that was doing their PhD in neuroscience, and they were also a therapist by trade. So I found myself in a laboratory at the UTS medical school in Sydney.
So the University of Technology in Sydney.
And so I'm sitting almost touching my client's feet and legs, we're wired up, so I've got wires all over my brain and so has she, and I've got connectors onto all of my fingers and my hearts. And so the research was around when is a therapist and client in sync and what's going on medically, i.e. heart rate, brain waves, etc., when you and the client are in sync and when you're not in sync. And so she invited a group of therapists to do about half a dozen sessions each. We didn't know the clients we were meeting. And we basically sat down, were wired up, were introduced to the client, and then for the next hour, it was a real experiment around how do you get into sync with somebody.
Mm. And was this over 10 sessions?
No, six.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was this Patricia
Stratford?
She was my lecturer.
Oh.
She told us. She actually told me about this research.
And I'm one of the therapists.
Oh, you're one of the guinea pigs.
That's right.
Oh, that's really, really interesting.
It
because
was.
You know, I did a summer class with her, and we actually talked about this research that she was doing. I think she just finished doing the actual testing stage. So it was really interesting from a point of view of the fact that she was able to talk about it. And I've actually used that with people,
yeah,
that having that knowledge, yeah, of how close and important it was.
It was quite incredible to be sitting in that laboratory, wired up, and I knew the moments where I felt that we were matching each other's kind of heart rate. You could just feel it in the room. And I could see Trish from her little laboratory window go kind of thumbs up or,
wow,
you know, if you weren't getting a thumbs up, you were like, okay, maybe we're not in sync. What's that like not to be in sync with a client?
I remember her showing us the graph of how you were out of sync in like sessions one and two and it gradually got closer and closer and closer to three. And then as the client realized that it was coming to an end, you started getting out of sync again.
Hmm.
Which that was one of the graphs that really stuck with me, was that, you know, things coming to an end and how they didn't necessarily purposely sort of extract themselves from that, but their body somehow made an effort to make that change,
yeah,
and get out of sync.
Yeah.
Which I thought was fascinating.
Without any candles, flowers, aesthetics whatsoever, you're in a laboratory, yeah, and yet the ability to kind of come into sync with somebody, to witness and to acknowledge and to work with them was, yeah, extraordinary. Mm.
That's isn't it a small world?
It is a small world.
I thought Canberra was a small world. So your client base is predominantly or almost exclusively LGBTIQ.
It keeps on changing.
A plus. Yeah. So it does keep changing.
It does.
Do you think that actually has an impact on how you work with clients because you are working within a very small community and a very sort of, you know, a marginal community, essentially?
Absolutely. Probably last year when the same-sex postal survey was going on in Australia was probably one of the toughest years I've experienced as a clinician. The level of minority stress that we were seeing coming through our doors was extraordinary. Even myself, I remember listening to Parliament one night on the way home where LGBTQI people were being discussed. Mm. And I hadn't felt for many, many decades, actually, and I'm 53, the level of dirtiness or shame that I felt about being a gay man. At one moment in Parliament when my life was being discussed by a group of liberal political members.
White guys.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I have at least three international listeners, so I'm just going to explain what the postal survey was all about.
Okay.
So Australia finally got with the program of equal marriage rights. But the way they did it, rather than doing what they did back in 1991 when our Prime Minister just went, well, we're just going to change the Marriage Act that says marriages between two people. We're just going to change it to exclusively between a man and a woman. Rather than reverting that, they decided to put it to the Australian people to, they called it a plebiscite, where we were able to vote on whether we thought gay people should be allowed to marry. And all that comes with that as being a married couple. And we overwhelmingly won, 63%.
I wouldn't say overwhelmingly, but it was a reasonable margin.
Yeah, there was pockets of the community that we knew was going to disappoint us. And then we live in the ACT, which is the Australian Capital Territory. It was definitely an overarching win here.
The ACT, the small territory that we are, was actually
about 350,000 people.
Yeah, was actually a huge result in terms of affirming LGBTQI same-sex marriage. Funny enough, I have a very close friend living in an inner west suburb of Sydney, a very green, very politically aware suburb, and yet the ultimate result in her suburb was no. And she was really dumbfounded, shocked by this, and left a real distaste in her mouth about, well, who are my neighbours? And how do I feel about my neighbours given that it's such a strong no vote in my neck of the woods? Interesting enough, why I think the yes vote caused a lot of people to think, oh, wonderful, we've got equality now. Recently in Sydney, our Sydney Anglican Diocese really, you know, made it very clear that the fight for equality isn't over. And interesting also in Australia, the test case we're going to have around the rugby union player Israel Folau and whether or not he had the right to put very anti-LGBTQI hate speech on his Facebook post.
But saying it was religious freedom.
Saying it was a religious freedom will actually, again, really test the resilience and the resolve of LGBTQI people in this country. And it will put it back in the spotlight.
Yeah, so the fight's not over.
Fight's definitely not over, no.
Yeah. So as a result of the plebiscite, the vote for marriage equality and whether the people thought we so what were you seeing coming through your door in your private practice?
People expected joy and there was. I remember being at the local very large public park when the vote was announced. I'd been asked to be there in case it was a no result and that people might be very emotionally impacted by a no. What I saw was actually a great deal of grief that I don't think people were expecting or realizing that they were holding within their somatic kind of system. And there was a lot of tears, a lot of disbelief. A lot of the older lesbian community that I know in my local area particularly impacted. I think this had a significant impact for them around no longer needing a man to marry and being legitimate in their own right as women being able to marry each other is the only way I can maybe put a spin on it. What really struck me was a couple of weeks later I had a client excitedly post the yes result, proposed to her girlfriend of many years, wonderful, yes, I'd love to marry you. My client excitedly rang her mother and her mother went, oh, really, that's lovely, but don't expect your dad and I at the wedding. It's not something we'd be comfortable about. And this kind of completely blew my client out of the water. This was a 20-year relationship. This was a relationship that she thought was supported by her parents. She had gone out of her way for most of her adult life to fit into her family and their value system and kind of toe the line and be a good, respectable sister, daughter, etc. And it caused her to actually go, you know what? I'm no longer going to try and please you. And you're not welcome at the wedding if you actually really don't support the fact that I'm a lesbian and I'm in love with my partner of 20 years. Mm. That was one of those landmark sessions that you never forget.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm sure that that's not the only time you heard that either.
No. But it was very soon after the yes vote, and I can remember being quite impacted by kind of the energy in the room. Bittersweet, or maybe sweet bitter, because, you know, the family, you know, my client so wanted the family's blessing and to be part of the day in which they will be married.
Well, as you know, as any couple
absolutely
would be, regardless of the couple, if you're marrying the person that you love, you want the people that you love and you thought respected your relationship to be there.
Mm.
So to suddenly discover that this relationship that you thought you had with these people is actually very different. Would have been, I would imagine, quite appalling to have been on the receiving end of that.
Yep.
Mm. Yeah. So you work with Gestalt. Tell us a little bit about how you work with Gestalt.
Well, I'm very pleased that I'm the second Gestalt therapist on this podcast series.
And who was the first?
Carmen. Hello, Carmen, if you're listening. fellow Gestaltist here. What attracted me to Gestalt was the fact that I was a gay man, and Gestalt was essentially when Fritz and Laura Perls moved from Germany to South Africa and then to New York. They met Paul Goodman, who was a gay man, a poet and a social activist, and the three of them really took Gestalt therapy and applied it to that time in New York when there was uprising, there was social change happening in the 60s in New York. And so I was quite taken by the fact that gay, lesbians, transgender folk were really included in Gestalt's early years. And worldwide, if I go to, say, one of the big worldwide Gestalt conferences, there's quite literally hundreds of fellow LGBTQI Gestalt therapists, and that's something that's very important to me. Mm. I feel at home. I don't have to hide any aspect of myself. I love that Fritz and Laura were free thinkers. Laura at the time in Berlin was mixing with the crowd that came up with Alexander technique and Bowen therapy and other bodily kind of somatic schools. Fritz went to Japan and was really fascinated by Zen Buddhism, one of the first big therapists to go over there. And he was a free thinker. And Laura was also very, very interested in the aesthetic of therapy. Apparently, I've spoken to a few old Gestalt therapists in New York who were clients of Laura, and you went, you had cake, you had coffee, you would listen to some music. That was all part of the therapy session with Laura. That really says something to me.
Wow, I remember going to university and being told that, you know, that it was this was what therapy looked like.
Mm.
You sure as hell never got offered cake.
No, Laura was a real ascetic. She believed that
that really fits in with
cultural
your...
culture was very important. And you know, I think Gestalt therapy's got a really bad rap over the years of being very kind of confrontational. I think we've got to remember that a lot of the footage we've seen of Fritz working, he was confrontational, but he was doing it as a demonstration.
Mm.
People that I've spoken to who had therapy with him said he was the most incredible, insightful therapist they've ever worked with. Mm.
Because you can YouTube Fritz Perls,
yes,
and actually see him in action. And I remember being shown some of his videos in. I didn't do the Gestalt module, but I did do that when we did the one where you had a little bit of a taste, like over the 12 weeks, you saw a different therapy type. And I remember seeing a video and going, "Oh my gosh!"
If you could
that's
see
a bit in your face,
if you could see him, and I think you're referring to Gloria, the old project, which still to this day I think is amazing in that.
Yeah.
Take one woman with a certain issue. She visited all of the top therapists of the time. They filmed each session
because Carl Rogers spoke to Gloria as well. Yes.
And drowned her in empathy.
Yes,
where Fritz and her smoke to the point where I don't think you can see either of them in the room, but you can hear their voices. And he agitates her. He sees something more than the fragile creature that she presents. And starts to agitate her into action. And then she starts to give it back to Fritz. Yeah. And he's delighted. He's like, oh, finally, you're in the room. Yeah. Finally, I'm getting some kickback, some chutzpah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an interesting session. Mm. And rumor has it that she actually went back and saw Fritz several times because she actually rated kind of what she got out of the session with him.
Yeah. Okay.
Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but certainly that was the rumor I was, you know, given.
So that,
and I'm quite proud of that.
So that Carl Rogers of unconditional positive regard and, you know, empathy plus as you say, drown her in empathy.
Yeah.
Doesn't always work for clients. Sometimes you need to give them a bit of a poke.
Yes. One of the things I love about Gestalt, and if you come for a session with me, I can guarantee at some point you're going to laugh. Humor is a really important tool in therapy, and it helps you hold things lightly. Mm. I don't think therapy always has to be, what's what I'm looking for, confrontational or earth-shattering. Mm. You can actually have a laugh in therapy. And, you know, so humor to me is something that I learnt in Gestalt therapy training to use wisely.
Oh, it has to be appropriate.
Yes.
Yes.
But then you're talking about working with LGBTQI folk who have a very different take on most things in the world. And so you find yourself laughing at a lot of different aspects of life.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. So I remember my very first meeting with a gay man was when I was about 18, and I wasn't even really aware of it. You know, it was, you know, it would have been 1990. Yeah, it would have been 1990. I was pretty green around the edges, and I was working at a theatre, and I met this usher called Alex, who I absolutely adored, and I remember him saying, "Hey, let's go for a drink." And I was like, "Yeah, that sounds like fun." And we went to Brighton in the UK.
Oh my lordy, gay central, Brighton.
You know that. I didn't. And we went to this bar called The Legend. And he was like, "Let's go to The Legend." And I'm like, it's The Legend. Like, it's clearly The Legend. I was like, I was totally green. And I'm sat in there and I'm drinking my Jack Daniels and Coke. And I'm like, there's a lot of guys in here. Like, where are all the women? And he's like, and he just looked at me, and honest to God, I had absolutely no clue. No clue. And then he was like, and then he just went, "Darling, darling, I'm an absolute raging queer." And I was absolutely dumbstruck.
And it's interesting because that, stereotype, if I can call it, of gay man in queer culture at the moment is quite ostracized.
Mm.
Everyone's, you know, to a certain extent trying to play the kind of butch, straight acting kind of male or the edgy kind of dyke.
Mm.
It's a shame because there was nothing wrong with the raging queen.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing was, I mean, he used to be just dressed in jeans and T-shirt, and it wasn't until he said, "I'm an absolute raging queer," that I kind of went, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And we had some great nights out.
I bet you did.
I need a gay best friend again.
I think you've got one.
Oh, thanks. But, yeah, no, it's a really interesting thing. So why do you think there's this change from being allowed to be the you know, the raging queen more towards that, considering we are supposedly becoming far more accepting and far more liberal? Why do you think there's that steer away from the stereotype of the raging queen?
Look, I think there could be hundreds of theories. My take on it is a conservatism and trying to kind of fit in middle ground or middle society and not be so outrageous, not be so radical. I think gay men have really had to wrestle with notions of masculinity, and in doing so maybe have become wanted to adopt that very butch male kind of stereotype. I think the porn industry and gay men's kind of relationship with porn changed, and it became more and more kind of masculine orientated.
Do you think the AIDS epidemic had anything to do with changing the face of possibly how you presented? Because if you presented in a particular way, then that could have been where you were.
Well,
and that stigma.
Yeah, my take on the AIDS crisis when it hit hugely in Sydney, it taught us how to care for each other. And I really want to honour the fact that I think that's one thing we learnt off lesbian women who were at the forefront of the AIDS crisis, was we learnt from them, no one's going to care for us. We're going to have to do it ourselves. We're going to have to set up all of the support systems and actually take care of each other.
Mm.
And that's what happened. Mm. And I owe a huge gratitude to all the lesbians out there who were, at the time, some of them were questioning, why are we so invested in helping gay men through this? But they taught us beautifully about how to take care of each other. Mm.
So in Canberra, there's a couple of organisations in Canberra. There's the AIDS Action Council, which I believe is in the middle of changing its name, which we haven't. I'll post that on the blog. And there's also Diversity ACT.
And AGA, Agenda Agenda.
Agenda Agenda. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
There's a whole lot of grassroots organisations within the LGBTQI community here in Canberra, as there are in Sydney and Melbourne and, other places, even further south in our little country town of Wagga and Albury Wodonga's becoming a vast gay mecca.
Wow. Albury Wodonga.
Albury Wodonga.
So, again, international.
Again, for our international.
For our three international listeners, Albury Wodonga is on the border of
New South Wales and Victoria.
Albury is in New South Wales and Wodonga is in Victoria.
Mm.
And they're literally right opposite sides of the river, basically, which flows through. So everybody just calls it Albury Wodonga. Which is why I couldn't tell you which way around they were.
but, a very rural area, a big university town where a lot of health and a lot of agriculture, a lot of sports kind of studies occur.
Mm.
It's a pretty masculine, tough town. And for them to have a growing LGBTQI population, I think is incredible, as is with Wagga Wagga.
Mm.
Again, country town.
That's an Air Force town.
Air Force town, university town, but a real growing LGBTQI town as well.
There's also growing, there's also sort of growing populations out in places like Broken Hill, which really is in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
And of course, famously is depicted in the Priscilla, Queen of the Desert as being.
I lived in Broken Hill for a while. And right. I can tell you that very interesting scene in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, where the three main actors dressed up in outrageous drag get off the bus. Now, the directors wanted the actors, that wasn't rehearsed. The town did not know what was going on because the director really wanted the town folks' very authentic response when they saw the three drag queens walking down the main street. We're talking very rough mining town.
Yeah, yeah, really,
The actors, I believe, were scared shitless of what was going to
happen. And one of them played General Zod in Superman.
Yes.
And they were scared witless.
Yes.
What about Cooper Pedy? Cooper Pedy's even more mining town.
Yes, yeah.
And, of course, that's where the famous scene where he goes out dressed as a woman and gets beaten up for it.
Yes.
Yeah. So fairly realistic depictions of the time.
A very rough town. And that scene could have gone either way. I think luckily the town folk just looked with amusement and I have no idea what this is all about, but we'll just keep on our way down the street.
I have stayed in that hotel
room. Yes, yes.
Yes, when I went out there when I was working for the road authority and I was working as a change manager, I had to go out to Broken Hill and I tracked that hotel room down because I was like, I want to stay in that.
It's the most amazing place.
Yes, it is.
The light, when you go out to Mutawinji or go out to some of the desert area and you realise how spectacular the Australian outback is.
But also how dangerous
it is. How dangerous, yes.
You really don't have to be far away from.
No, but I like that. I like that juxtaposition of kind of, you know, wild but dangerous at the same time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I have a friend who regularly goes out that way to photograph birds and plants.
Mm. And it's a huge artist mecca. The light out there is extraordinary.
Yes. Mm. Yes, I've taken some quite amazing photographs
when I was out there.
So, yeah. So why were you living out in Broken Hill?
I had a friend doing a project out there and I was working for an airline, so I would go out there for chunks of time and drive around with her as she was going out to more remote areas to do some health consultations.
Right. So were you a therapist at the time?
No. I was working for our national carrier, Qantas,
right,
at the time.
In which capacity?
Well, this is going to be very funny. Special handling.
Oh, please tell.
So special handling was a term when, let's say, you're in a wheelchair and you're going to get on a flight and that flight may take you through several different countries, airports, different airlines. There has to be a team that coordinates how you're going to be managed. And it's called special handling.
So when you're traveling alone.
Yeah.
And, okay.
So we do a lot of special cases around wheelchairs, blind people. If you're someone who has a guide dog, that guide dog also has to be accounted for and worked out how we're going to manage that journey for the guide dog.
Right.
Seats sometimes have to be rearranged in an aircraft.
Wow.
When there's suddenly a diversion midway through a flight because someone's having a heart attack, our little team in Sydney that worked 24 hours would have to then start planning what we were going to do with that 300-odd passengers on board that were supposed to be heading to Singapore but now are heading to
Brisbane.
Somewhere else.
Wherever.
Yes, that's right.
Wow. Okay.
Special handling.
So hotels and all that sort of stuff until the next flight comes in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long did you do that for?
About 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Mm.
So how on earth did you end up as a therapist?
Oh, I still wonder that sometimes. I think just I'm a nosy, curious person. And I started life as a chef and then graduated from being a very, you know, unhappy chef to going out onto the floor and discovering that I quite liked being a waiter and talking to people and being the conduit between the kitchen and the floor. had a certain amount of power, being able to go back and say to the chef, right, this is happening, that's happening, or, you know, if there was a special that they were cooking, I was able to translate and sell that special better than any other waiter.
Yeah.
And I suppose I then left chefing, and this is going to sound strange, but I think I've done every gay occupation you can do. So then I became a hairdresser.
Oh,
I think I am, because then I became a hairdresser. And I discovered that working in very close proximity to people, you know, when you go to the hairdresser, often people share a lot of secrets, and you work very closely. It's a very intimate job being a hairdresser.
Yeah.
And so I learnt a lot about building intimacy and building rapport with people really quickly.
You've got your hands.
I love shampooing somebody.
It is a very
tactile thing.
It's a very. I go to a barber because I used to have a hairdresser in Sydney who I didn't mind doing that. Yep. I went to a couple here and I just kind of went,
yes.
And now I go to a barber and he's wonderful.
Yep.
And I went in to have my hair cut a few weeks ago and I'm like, where's Dave? Oh, he's had to go for a funeral. I'm like, God damn it. In my head, I didn't say it.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh, I'll come back. He's like, sorry, I can cut your hair. I'm like, Dave knows how to do it.
Yeah.
And I came back. So it's a very intimate and it is very, very hairdressing.
So
it's also very, very cliche.
Yeah, it is. I've airline chef, hairdresser. I've worked at IKEA in visual display.
I was going to say, can you put together a chair in like 5 seconds?
No, I can't. I'm horrible at IKEA. But I'm very good at their soft furnishings. I'm a whiz with their soft furnishings department. I can spot a good cushion or a bad cushion and 10 paces away and know where that will go and how we're going to use it.
Interior design.
Interior design, yes. It came out of actually being very frustrated myself and being a client of other therapists and thinking, you know, God, I could give this a go. And I started to volunteer with what was our local LGBTQI counselling hotline. So in Australia we have a national kind of talk back or helpline called Lifeline.
Yep.
And there was a local gay version of that. So I started there and got bored with just talking with people over the phone and thought, I can do more than this, and went and I think I spent 2 years working out which therapy modality to study, and I got completely...
There's so many.
Yeah, there are, and I got completely bogged down. And then finally this lovely Gestalt therapist that I met said to me, I guarantee you'll find a husband if you come and do the Gestalt therapy training. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll give it a go, not realising Gestalt's history with LGBTQI. And once the first year was done, I was kind of quite hooked by Gestalt therapy.
Do you have a master's in Gestalt, is that right?
No. I started to do a master's in social research actually before transferring to studying therapy. I'm toying with doing a Masters of Sexual Health next year because when you're dealing with LGBTQI folk, sexual identity and gender identity are really the essence often of what you're working with in the room. And sex is, you know, for gay men, sex is often an area of delight, disgust, or depression or anxiety. I'm either not getting enough, I'm worried I'm getting too much and people think that I'm, you know, easy. I'm worried that I'm not this or that enough for partners, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how it started.
So
and I can't believe that 10, 12 years of being a therapist have moved since I graduated.
Do you think that the industry has changed in the last
hugely
decade?
Okay. I think you can see that in the current dilemma that the psychology world has at the moment in Australia, where the psychology degree is undergoing a complete change. For a while, I thought back in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was talk that counselling as a subject that you go and study at a college or university should actually be phased out, because the government and their mental health delivery and how they fund it and who they refer people to, it was mostly all based around psychology. And for a while, there were a number of counselling schools that really ethically thought about, should we actually be churning out students, when ultimately, unless people are going to pay for them in private practice, they're not going to get jobs.
Well, I have to confess, that was one of the things that happened to me when I came out of university from having done the course. You know, I'd be, you know, trawling through Seek and, you know, the job boards, and it would be like counsellor, and then you'd read through it, and then it would be must be a clinical psychologist or a social worker. And I'm like, God damn it, that's not a counsellor. That's a psychologist or a social worker.
You know, I think the interesting thing for your listeners is to think about, you go and study psychology for 6 years. You don't do, there's no requirement for you to do any personal therapy work, i.e. to understand who you are.
Yes.
And what your kind of shadow sides are, how you operate in the world, work through some of your own issues. You then, at the end of 6 years, where you know a lot about certain illnesses and diagnoses and, you know, how the brain works, you then have to spend an inordinate amount of time actually sitting with people in the room and learning how you do that. Counselling, which generally speaking, depending on which school you go to, is going to be anywhere between 2 and 4 years, you have to actually do a fair amount of personal therapy work from day one. From day one, you are actively doing role plays. You're actively learning the art of being with people, of how to build rapport, how to repair if you get it wrong for a client.
The first subject that I did when I first started studying this was Counselling 101.
Yeah.
And we basically spent 5 weeks of the 12 weeks trimester just doing nonverbals, practicing our nonverbals and our minor verbals. So the nodding, the winking, the
and the reflecting and the reflaming.
So I've just heard you say, is that correct?
Mm.
And that for 5 weeks we did that, and then we pretty much, that was all we were allowed to do. We weren't allowed to ask any questions. Mm. And then we gradually, over the next few weeks, we were allowed to start introducing the most basic of questions, no challenging questions, no nothing. And then after that, we did Counselling 102, which is actually when I met Patricia Stafford.
Ah.
So, and that was a summer school. So it was 5 solid days, and it was from 9:30 till 5 for 5 days. That was the longest week of my life.
Mm.
Because it was absolutely exhausting, because we were role-playing. There were 6 of us. We were taking it in turns to role-play. We had to share personal experiences. And then we had like 8 weeks or whatever it was to do the essays that we needed to do as a result of it. But, yeah, absolutely. First two subjects.
Mm. So it's just interesting. We have a wonderful GP in Australia who also is a magnificent journalist, and he has something called the Health Report. And I think it was last year, he did a major journalistic kind of piece around reviewing, evaluating Australia's mental health care plan strategy. Mm. So this, for your international listeners.
We've spoken about what a mental health care plan is in season one, episode 6.
So he was a GP, also brilliant journalist, Norman Swan, I love you.
Yes.
He evaluated and kind of looked at, wow, okay, the government, both major political parties have overspent by millions of dollars on the mental health care plan strategy of sending somebody off to a psychologist for 6 to 10 sessions. It's never been properly evaluated. Any attempts to do so generally reveal that it actually hasn't met any of its key performance indicators. Wow. And essentially we're just continually throwing a lot of money and sending people to psychologists. And sadly, it's the clients that I worry about who often aren't getting any outcome.
And, you know, because they have this pressure that they've got to fix everything in the shorter period of time. And, of course, in Canberra we have a shortage of available psychologists, which means that if you go to your GP in crisis, you've probably got a 6 to 8 weeks
yep.
wait before you can get your first appointment, and then you're probably looking at between 4 and 5 weeks between appointments, which if you're in crisis is not very helpful.
Well, no, it's not. And I had, you know, just recently I felt I needed to go and talk to somebody and I really wanted to try a certain school of psychology and a certain school of therapy. So I found the psychologist that I wanted, had the initial session, and then it was a 4 week wait, and then another 4 week after that and another 4 weeks after that. And it was a really interesting experience to be that client that had to try and both work on issues but also maintain a certain equilibrium in between the 4 weeks. Whereas I see some clients weekly, I see some clients fortnightly. I generally don't do monthly because by the time you've checked back in and you've got an update on where they've been in the last month, you've 20, 30 minutes through the session. For some clients, you know, long term, it might work. But generally, I think weekly or fortnightly, while you're cooking, while you're working on a particular issue, is actually really important.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, someone's finally decided, I want to tackle this issue that I've been struggling with. You want to strike while the iron's hot. You want to work with that sense of agency that the client's presented with.
I must admit, I've had one client who was cooking, like cooking, and was able to afford to come every 4 days for about 3 or 4 weeks, and then she dropped back to weekly, and then she dropped back to fortnightly, and now it's ongoing as fortnightly. But for that immediate, you know, she was lucky enough that she could afford it, that she was just like, no, I need to power through this. And, you know, when it did drop back, she was like, you know, I've got enough time to reflect, but also to keep the momentum up of actually making changes. And, you know, it meant that she was able to make some huge changes in her life without having to wait a month in between sessions.
So, you know,
she'd tried that path before, which is when how
well
she
it didn't work for me. I have to be frank. In the end, after about the third attempt to get in, I just to see the therapist, I just thought, no, this isn't working for me.
That's unfortunate.
And that was quite eye opening for me to kind of go back. I hadn't been a client for a little while, and it really gave me some insights into my work as a therapist.
I think it's actually really interesting to go, because I've recently done the same thing. I had a number of clients presenting with the same issue, and I realized that it was striking a little bit too close to home. And I'm like, you know how they say, you know, when you're a therapist, you get sent the ones you need.
Oh, that's I don't know who said that, but it is the mantra in therapy. You will be challenged. You will have your buttons pressed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was working in EAP, and I had about six days in EAP, so over 3 weeks. I would have had in that time, I would have had at least 3 people each day presenting with this same topic, and it was really hitting me a little bit too close. And I just kind of went, maybe that old problem is starting to rear its head a little bit. So I, ironically enough, my EAP has an EAP, so I rang the EAP, and I had to because of the way it worked, it was over the phone. But it was really interesting to talk to this person because, you know, she knows that I'm a therapist, so, she, you know. But there was a couple of times when I'm kind of like, ooh, can you say that to a client? Because there were some things that were quite sort of, you know, quite judgy. And but I've never, but the only time I've ever felt judgy was when I went to see a client and I went to see a therapist and she told me that I couldn't join her group because I clearly still had anger issues. But then I could tell she was really disappointed that I just went, okay. Because I didn't. But she told me that I did. I never went to see her again.
You raise an interesting question I've always been fascinated by in therapy is the hierarchy. So I see clients, I go to supervision. I recently became a supervisor as well. And then your supervisor goes for supervision and then that supervisor goes, I kind of somehow I'd like to find out who the grand boobah of supervision is. Who's the one person up the top of the chain?
Yeah.
I've always wondered about this.
But also therapists seeing other therapists.
Yes.
Because that also happens.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, I think it's really important to continue the therapeutic journey because, you know, we have that wounded healer sort of thing that we do. But we've all been there. We've all sort of had our experiences. But it's really interesting how we choose to learn from them.
Mm.
I think that's the thing that we need to take away from actually having our own therapy, which of course brings me back to what you were saying about how when you're studying to be a psychologist, there's no requirement as part of that study to actually do your own reflection in there.
And I really wonder how that plays out in the therapy room when that very young or not so young, but new psychologist, newly graduated, sits in a room with somebody and it begins. Because my sense is they have no, you know, they might have done a placement or two for a while, but, you know, I really wonder what that experience is like.
Maybe I can find a guest who can answer that question.
Yes, that would be a juicy.
If you're a psychologist that wants to talk about that, your please.
Your first session.
Hit me up. Yeah, hit me up.
Do you remember your first session as a counsellor?
Oh, yeah, I do. Oh, my God.
You can have a whole podcast on first sessions. Oh,
yeah, like it was yesterday. Yeah. I remember being stuck in a room. So I did my placement at, it was called ASHM. It was the Australian Institute of Sexual Health Medicine, and it was an offshoot of Impotence Australia. It was based in Sydney, and I remember being put in the room with this guy who was a plant, I found out afterwards, which was actually really great, and we had to do a sexual health. So we were told, but we weren't told that he'd been primed, but we were told this client's coming in and you need to do a sexual history with him. And I just remember sitting there and I was having to, and I've always seen myself as being pretty open and sort of thing, but sitting there, sitting across this room from a guy who would have been in his 70s, asking for his sexual history, he was a gay man,
was
very eye-opening. And I'm pretty sure I blushed a few times.
I bet.
He was telling me about drug use. He was, because we had to take all the history, entire sexual health history. And it was interesting. I mean, this is a guy who remembers going to New York and hanging out with Andy Warhol. He had some stories.
Oh,
yeah. He had some stories to tell. So, yeah, it was definitely, you know, by that point I'd had heaps of role play experience. And it was really quite.
It's really different to go from the role play to that first real session.
Yeah, and of course before that I didn't know that he'd done about 40 of these things. Because he was a friend of the guy who I had spoken to get my placement. So he was well-versed in what he was talking about. And afterwards, so it was me and there was one other girl. And afterwards we did like immediate supervision after that with the guy who'd hired us. And he asked us, he says, well, could you tell when he was telling the truth? And we were like, well, why wouldn't he? He goes like, well, because clients lie. He was like, well, because there are things in there that weren't true. And we're like, and at this point, we're like, how do you know that? He was like, well, because I've known him for like So it was a really, it was a wonderful lesson. It was terrifying, but it was a wonderful lesson. If nothing else, just to hear the sentence, which had never been uttered in the 5 years that I'd been doing study. Clients lie.
Or embellish or underplay something that.
Oh, well, why would you do that? What was your first session?
My first session, I kept putting it off and putting it off until my trainers were like, you have to do it. It was in a library, so a makeshift library at this training institute. Yeah. I remember the young girl, she had hair like Nicole Kidman. And that's,
which, what, the frizzy the, one no, or the slick
well, no,
one?
Just the, well, it was very early Nicole, so she was still a natural redhead.
Okay.
But I was, that's how we began, actually, by she was playing with her hair and I started kind of doing that, imagining that I had long hair, and that was our starting point.
So you were mirroring her?
In a way, yeah. And it just started, and all of my fears dissipated within 5 minutes.
Right.
It felt like a play session rather than, you know, a serious therapy session. I remember.
And was she a real client or was she a, was she?
She was a student, what we called a student client. So she was volunteering. She had an issue she wanted to work on, but she just signed up and got news that she was getting, you know, student counsellors, and she was happy to. To do that.
Yeah. Wow.
Hmm. Yeah.
How amazing. So we're coming to the close of our episode. We're going to be a little bit over the 1 hour because we've...
We might have to edit.
No, don't edit. Don't edit. I always ask my guests, what do you think the future of mental health is in Australia?
Oh, I've been thinking about this really important question. I think we're at a really interesting cross-section. I don't believe that the apps that are all out there that seemingly are reproducing faster than rabbits reproduce, for an app for anxiety, an app for depression. I'm a bit dubious about technology's future in mental health. I don't think that therapy can ever be replaced by, say, robots. I think we're safe to say that there will always be a space for human-to-human contact that happens in a therapy room. I think if you follow someone as groundbreaking as Esther Perel, how she has now, as a relationship therapist for 30 years in private practice, where she's basically sat in a room and worked with couples, she's now worked out that therapy has a lot to teach the wider world about how we interact. And so her new podcast series is actually about workplace relationships. So she's taking therapy out of the therapy room and into the real world. And I actually think this is where therapy needs to go, is we can't be locked away in little rooms. We actually have something really important to offer, which is interaction, witnessing, experience in various careers. And we're too valuable to actually to be locked away. I also think that as more and more people are lonely and isolated and living on their own, their need for human contact is actually really important. So I actually think therapy, I've taken a client out once because they really wanted to celebrate their 60th birthday and they had no one to do it with. So we had a therapy session that involved going to a restaurant and actually honouring and talking about him turning 60. Wow. Now, certain codes of conduct and certain therapy schools might go, oh, that's really inappropriate, Rodney, but I think that's where therapy needs to go.
That human contact.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for allowing me to come into your home and smell these beautiful flowers that are
which you'll be taking home table. Fill your bedroom.
How exciting.
Or your therapy room. Or both.
Oh, my therapy room doesn't go with pink. They do go with lilies though.
There you go.
So thank you, Rodney. Thank you for sharing some of your secrets and really being very, very generous with your time and with your thoughts today. Thank you for sharing your secrets. And even sharing the secrets into the podcast as well. Thank you for that. Thank you to Nick, my podcast guy and sound guru, for doing the wonders that he does with the sound. Thank you to you, the listener, for listening over and over again and subscribing and rating. Your subscriptions and your rates really, really do help build this podcast up. Thank you for that. If you enjoy the podcast and you feel like supporting it, you can if you head over to Patreon and search for Secrets We Share. If you're interested in sharing your secrets, then please send me a message through my website, secretkeepercounseling.com.au. Until next time, stay well.
Thank you for listening to Secrets We Share. If you're interested in sharing some of your secrets, please visit our website at secretkeepercounseling.com.au. Keep an ear out for our next episode soon.